All right, welcome back, everybody, to episode number 7 of Things We Read This Week. I'm Jordan Annos, back with Hunter Almgren. This week, we've got a packed agenda talking about computer scientists winning Nobel Prizes, an update on nuclear power and the rollout of Blackwell, New York Times suing Perplexity, some feedback on AI-powered products like Copilot, updates on x86. It's going to be a busy show. Before we get into that, Hunter, how are you doing? What you been up to?
Good. Yeah, I was actually I was out on a full disconnected vacation last week, which was nice. You know, I try to go to places that don't have cell service so that I'm not tempted to look at anything, and it ends up being super relaxing. So I highly recommend everybody do that at least once in a while, because, you know, as I've talked about on previous episodes, I don't even like smart fridges and all that shit. Like, give me the dumbest fridge best, you know, or Home Depot has. So, you know, the disconnected part of it is always refreshing for me. You know, I come back usually feeling pretty good.
Are you feeling good? It's been 1 week back. Are you ready to keep working and keep talking tech every day?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm back, ready to go.
All right. Well, speaking of computers being places they don't belong, the Nobel Prize was given out 2 weeks ago. Multiple Nobel Prizes. One in physics went to computer scientists Jeffrey Hinton and John Hopfield for Hopfield networks and backpropagation in artificial neural networks. I don't think many people thought computer scientists could win a Nobel Prize in physics, I would say it's very unexpected, but got that. And then we've also got the Nobel Prize in chemistry being given to researchers from Google DeepMind. John Jumper and Demis Hassabis, who created the model AlphaFold for protein structure prediction. Pretty crazy to see that what's been... I think the second one was rumored for a long time that these guys were, you know, it had such an impact on chemistry and biology that really just all kind of drug development that we'd be expecting to see this. But I don't know, what's your take on computer science taking over the hard sciences here?
It's pretty interesting, right? Because pretty much, as far as I know, pretty much every computer science person, you know, has been relegated to the Turing Award, right? Which is, you know, the highest I think you can achieve in the computer science field. And now to see, you know, they were always separate, right? Like, you had the Nobel Prize for this, and then you had the Turing Award for computer science. And to see that basically that division disappear, I think, to me, underscores what we've talked about on prior episodes of, like, computer science and, you know, people getting excited about data centers and getting excited about, you know, technology, just like everyday people getting excited about it. This is a continuation of that, right? Like, that's at least my initial take on it. You know, when I first read it was, okay, wow, like, people, this is a trend that's continuing forward.
Yeah. So you don't have any sort of, reservations that the Nobel Prize is just jumping on the AI bandwagon like everybody else and deciding that this is the year it has to be it has to be an AI year?
I'm trying not to look at it that way, but I can definitely see how, like, oh,
self-promotion,
wow,
opportunity here.
I was gonna say, yet another organization claiming that they're in the AI space and doing AI things, like, great. I can understand why some people would take issue with that, for sure.
I didn't say it. Well, I just said it, but I don't necessarily believe that.
Yeah, no.
Just because I said it, yeah.
I don't know. I'm okay with it. You know, I think that regardless of your feelings on AI, I think that the research and... you know, what's going into the advancement of the space is pretty groundbreaking. Like, this is stuff nobody's ever seen before. And it's also being iterated on at a rate that you haven't really seen before, right? I mean, like the iteration of new models, new techniques, new ways of doing things, new ways of deploying, new ways of integrating into platforms and software. Like you're just not seeing this at the speed, in other areas, right? So like the speed of innovation, the speed of iteration is like breakneck speed at this point, right? So I think that I totally understand why, a Nobel Prize would go to somebody in that space, just because it's pretty incredible. Some of the things that are coming out of this research. I also, like I said, totally understand the face value of like, wow, Nobel Prize committee is just hot on AI. Great. Just like everyone else.
Yeah, so people are using this to make a little bit of a political point. I'll share on screen the tweet where the Nobel Prize Twitter account announced the award in physics to Hopfield and Hinton, and then on the right the announcement for Demis Hassabis and John Jumper. I want to point out one thing that Geoffrey Hinton said. He was in San Francisco when he received the award or the call about the award, and then he did a an interview with the University of Toronto, and about 3 minutes into the interview, he said, he in his opening statement, he said he's particularly proud that one of his students had a hand in firing Sam Altman from OpenAI. Dr. Hinton is well known as being somebody who has signed a number of, papers and letters, and is very concerned about the development of AGI and its impact on, human life, I guess, and agency. So I guess he views, and he assumes his student Ilya, who's there that day at Google celebrating the prize with him, I think they both assume that Sam is being a little bit more cavalier with the use of AGI in daily life than the researchers might like. So interesting that the, there's ways for a prize to recognize a life's achievement, a life's work and research is kind of being used to make a political point right now in real time. So, yeah.
Yeah, this actually reminds me of like a personal experience. So, years ago, so there's this school in Chicago, this audio engineering school that people can go to that primarily focuses on electronic music. So EDM, dubstep, whatever. And they had invited for their graduating class, they had invited Steve Albini to come speak. If you don't know who Steve Albini is, he's a very famous and influential engineer and producer in the music space. I mean, he is like the godfather of grunge. He did a lot in the 90s, some very famous work. He gets up there, and the first thing he says is, "Electronic music isn't music. It sucks."
Oh boy. Okay.
Yeah, so that this situation, like I am glad like my student was there to help fire Sam Altman. Like this reminds me of a very similar situation where Steve Albini goes in front of a bunch of, kids who just spent the last year studying electronic music and goes, "Electronic music isn't music. It's crap. It sucks."
Interesting, interesting parallels. Well, okay, let's wrap and say it's interesting to see that like ChatGPT and the whole wave of LLMs that seems to have started the OpenAI trend and sorry, the like AI trend, the Gen AI trend right now, was obviously all part of research that was done by OpenAI. And it was started with people like Sam Altman, Greg Brockman, Ilya Sutskever, Mira Moradi, Dario Amodei. Like all of those people have gone their separate ways and formed their own separate companies or are working on their own ventures. Like Dario's the head of Anthropic. Ilya started his company SSI. Mira's a free agent, but seems to have something cooking. So yeah, can they, what's the best for the industry or for the progress of research at large? Is it everybody working on one goal all at one company and staying friends, or is it, decentralization, a bit of innovation that's promoted by them all being in different spots now? Well, I guess we'll see. But transition to speak about something that's related is that OpenAI keeps moving forward. So we've been talking about nuclear power and the build out. Here we go. We've seen that two things to share. OpenAI is beginning to secure its own compute capacity outside of the data center deal it's secured with Microsoft, despite Microsoft firing up Three Mile Island and ordering a bunch of GPUs. And here's the rumor specifically that OpenAI is getting 100,000 B200s from an initial 206 megawatts of renewable energy leased from Oracle, not Microsoft, designed, built, and operated by Crusoe. That's going to come online in the first half of next year. They claim a record-setting construction timeline here. We saw Elon turn on a cluster of 100,000 H100s in like 100 days or something. And
it was actually less. Jensen yesterday was talking about it on a podcast. He said that the actual time from basically after the nodes had been racked, installed, cabled, and everything powered up, the actual time to get everything initialized to running was only 16 days. He actually quoted them. He said that he called, what did he say? He referred to the XAI guys as superhuman.
Yeah.
because he didn't think that anyone was able to stand up a cluster of that size in that short amount of time.
Yeah. So I think I'm putting the 100 days as more of the like site prep electricians
and
lay some concrete down, ship in some natural gas generators to the parking lot, negotiate with Memphis based politicians for access to the grid to power some of this stuff. Like there was something before the GPUs arrived, but
of course,
yeah, 17 days to like doing a you know, GPU burn run is absurd. Like mm-hmm. we're talking, I mean, in my experience, that's like a year. Like people will take delivery of GPUs and then it'll be at least months. Certainly, like most people are going, it's a year before it's put into production once you get all of the failures and stuff out of the way. So anyway, pretty crazy to see the speed at which this is moving. Just like, just to be clear.
Yeah, here, I'll pull it up real quick.
Yeah, the price tag on this cluster, 100,000 B200s, according to Crusoe, their joint venture, is $3.4 billion just to fund the infrastructure to build it out. What do you got there for the quote from Jensen?
Oh, I had just brought up what I just said, the article where he was quoted calling him superhuman because of, you know, he said it was singular that no one's ever been able to do that before.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild stuff.
So, okay. Where do you want to go from here? You want to keep talking about some build outs?
Yeah. So what I thought was interesting, and we don't have to spend a ton of time on this, was that not only is Amazon signing an agreement with Dominion Energy, which, okay, yeah, everyone's signing agreements with energy companies, they're also hiring people to develop their own small modular reactors. Like they're getting into like, They're taking the vertical integration play and they're going, you know what, we're not even going to buy anybody else's. We're going to make our own. And I think what's interesting about that is that's the exact same approach they took to building AWS. They said, look, we're not going to buy commodity servers. Like we're going to build our own. We're going to design our own boards, design our own chips. You know, we're going to fork off of the Open Compute Foundation and do our own thing. And here they go again, right? Just the exact same model. Like, yep, we're going to go hire a bunch of nuclear engineers and we're going to do it ourselves.
Yeah, I thought the Amazon Tiny Homes thing where you can build like a prefab house for $20,000 and put it on mm-hmm. your own plot of land was crazy, but we're now going to have Amazon Basics for small modular reactors.
Oh man, I can't
like,
wait
you
to
get
order
the Amazon
one of those
Basics batteries, right? Duracell mm-hmm. and Energizer don't like when they compare against that, but
hell yeah, dude. Yeah. I can't wait to order the Amazon Basics SMR to stick in my house.
Send off online. I'll Prime 2-day shipping for 50 megawatts here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, if you spend $50 more million, we'll get it to you overnight, 5 a.m. to 8 a.m.
Oh man. Yeah, it's funny. I don't know. But look, I remember seeing a technology executive when Amazon was starting, and they were starting with the outposts and snowball, snowplow, whatever these get your data to the cloud things
Snowmobile,
were.
snow, it was Snowball, and then they had Snowmobile, which was like a giant truck, like a semi truck of hard drives. Snowball was like I think it was like about that big, like the size of a toolbox, for doing the initial seed of your data into AWS.
Yeah, so they were going on this thing, and I remember somebody saying something about okay, they can run their data centers, but they don't know what it's like to come into a customer data center. All that's comes with that. Every
Right.
time a drive breaks, you got to roll a truck. And I remember just thinking, really? Amazon is the company that we're going to challenge on competency with logistics? this is the most operationally efficient company ever. Remember, there's a guy in a podcast, Tor Kesch's podcast, a guy named Patrick, forget his last name. He was talking about during the COVID vaccine rollout how it was strange that the US didn't kind of co-opt the top tech companies to work with them the way that they did with World War II. It was like at that time, they just kind of took over the big car manufacturers and said, hey, sir, now you're a captain in the army. Now you're manufacturing cars. What do you need to get it done? It's like, how do we possibly distribute these vaccines? Well, what if Jassy was suddenly a captain in the military and says, here you go, sir. What do you need to get it done?
Yeah, do free next day delivery on vaccines. I mean, so that's what it's the National Defense Production Authorization Act, I believe is what it's called, that was used in World War II to basically convert all of these like private business owners to like manufacturing things for the war, right? So, and it was everything from, not just ammunition, but like bandages and cars, and there were famous, car companies that, they made temporarily, military vehicles, right? I mean, they basically just said, okay, everyone's got to play a part of this, and what support do you need from us? It is interesting that they didn't take that approach with, with COVID, and I mean, they did to a degree, right? Microsoft had that large cluster that they basically opened up for free for everyone to use for like vaccine research and stuff. But I know that's not
Yeah,
what you're
it's kind
talking
of
about at
performative,
all.
yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah,
That's
I think.
like a feel good puff piece to like, yeah, we're doing good here, guys. We're solving vaccine problems.
Well, okay, they did, right? But I mean, they were very clear at the time. This is about research for future stuff, right? It's not about the actual response during the current
Right.
pandemic. And we don't need to go back and relive COVID, but the interesting thing that I think we talked about a second ago is if there's this AI arms race that's happening between the US and China, China's effectively got maybe three companies working on this, and the symbiosis with the state is there. This is not the way the US works, where the top lab splits into 10 fragments, and then there's multiple other labs, and there's multiple big tech companies who all kind of have their own agendas. The US seems to have all the resources to be the world leader in AI, but marshaling them and having them work on one training run instead of having every individual tech company go SMR, and then even OpenAI and Microsoft can't work together. They have to turn to Crusoe to get some capacity. Sure, it's the work of the free market, but it's not necessarily. I don't think that's how the 10 trillion and 100 trillion parameter model run gets done. So,
I agree, but
see.
it would take, everyone always says, oh, it doesn't take an act of Congress to do this. Well, it actually probably would take an act of Congress to get all of these people to work together and do a singular run, right?
Yeah.
I
Well,
mean,
let's talk about the utility of that because, I mean, there's a couple model releases this week that were really cool. Mistral came out with some small models that run on the phone and run on the device, like a laptop or something like that, the 3 billion and 7 billion parameter range, kind of 7 billion being in the range of like one GPU. There it is. And then we also saw NVIDIA release Nemotron with claims that it's going to beat GPT-4o and Claude 3.5 Sonnet. We'll see in the chatbot arena. It does, It does good on some predictive benchmarks, and my vibe test is that it's pretty good so far. But, you know, the product market fit for AI is not there yet. And that yeah. discussion was in the zeitgeist again this week. So I want to read two things here. One is from a guest blog on the Latent Space podcast newsletter. Do we yet have an answer to the $600 billion question, which we've talked about, the Sequoia Capital thing, right? It is now consensus that the CapEx on foundation model training is, quote, the fastest depreciating asset in history. I think this is such a clear, like, summary of what we've seen. The speed at which people throw out Llama 2 endpoints for Llama 3, Llama 3 endpoints for Llama 3.1, and now if they need multimodality, 3.1 for 3.2, is incredible. As soon as the next training run happens, you throw out the previous model. Like, yep. automatically, right? There's nuances about the prompts, and, you know, these things are fine-tuned. They have different, you know, possibly different behavior on different tasks. But, like, there's no reason not to upgrade when the new weights come and you get the benefits of the training run. And it's like you're spending $100 million to have this 15 gig file, this 100 gig file that is disposable. Like, you
yeah,
just
I mean,
throw it out like it's a battery.
It's wild. Look at what you and I just did an hour ago, right? Like, deploy Nemotron, add it to continue and switch over to that. Okay, goodbye, 3.170B. Like, you're out. Yeah. Nemotron's in. Like, that's how quickly it happens. And, you know, the cost behind doing a training run to build these is, as we've talked about plenty of times, astronomical. And if that cluster can't be reused to build something better, you know, next training run, something bigger, more parameters, you know, better outputs, whatever it is, yeah, it's throw it out and start over. I mean,
yeah.
Then it's like with NVIDIA continuing to release, you know, their GPU release cadence, right? I mean, Jensen talked about this at GTC, how he wants to be iterating every year. It's like, are we all just supposed to throw this shit out every year and, like, buy the new?
Well, yeah, the current trend is, like, you build a massive cluster, you do one massive training run on it, then you use it for some fine-tuning, and by the time the next cluster is getting delivered, that cluster is being converted into inference capacity, right, for that model.
Yeah.
But, I mean, NVIDIA was shipping V100 until like 2021. A100 was released in 2020, I think. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, H100 was 22, 23. And now we've got Blackwell is like 24, 25. It's been about 2 years each. These systems have 5-year life cycle for the support contract.
Yep.
And many people sweat them to 7, 8, 9 years, right? There was this crazy stuff a couple of years ago when AWS and GCP revised guidance to the street saying, we're going to run the servers for another year, and that's going to do X to our bottom line, and off their stock price goes because suddenly they don't have to retire the servers in 6 years. They can do it in 7 or something like that.
Right.
And it's just, I mean, you can still go get K80s on like a Kepler GPU released in like 2014. On AWS, right? That's like a 10-year-old yeah. GPU. Probably this one manufactured in 2016 or something. But, you know, the idea that, like, existing GPU flops are going to be used for future work is pretty clear.
Yeah.
I'll read something else that I think is interesting here, because it's not just about the performance of the model. It's always about the performance of the application and what value users are getting from it. So who knows about users getting value from software? I mean, Mark Benioff, CEO, founder of Salesforce, you know, founder CEO is a is a pretty obvious title that you know something about the company you're running, right? And he's out there on Twitter, you know, talking smack right now. So I just want to read this. Benioff says, when you look at how Copilot, you know, the Microsoft Copilot built into the operating system, how Copilot has been delivered to customers, it's disappointing. It just doesn't work, and it doesn't deliver any level of accuracy. Gartner says it's spilling data everywhere and customers are left cleaning up the mess. To add insult to injury, customers are then told to build their own custom LLMs. I've yet to find anyone who's had a transformational experience with Microsoft Copilot or the pursuit of training and retraining custom LLMs. Copilot is more like Clippy 2.0. Shrugging emoji.
Clippy 2.0. That's amazing.
So, you know, hot take from Mark. I know plenty of people who have good experiences training and retraining custom LLMs, at least fine-tuning them. But I have to agree, I have no good experience with Microsoft Copilot built into the OS right now, like Copilot 365. No. GitHub Copilot, different story. But the vibe from users that I get is like, if this AI thing doesn't work right away, I'm just not going to trust it. I'm going to dismiss it forever. Yeah. You get the same feeling about this stuff?
I do. And I liken it to just general experience on browsing the internet, right? I mean, you go to a website that takes longer than, let's say, 2 seconds to load, you close the tab and you go find a different link, right? I equate it to that, right? It's instant gratification. Like, if this doesn't do exactly what I need it to do in a satisfactory manner right out of the box, like, forget it. It's a piece of shit. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and it just seems like the companies that are going to make that return on that $600 billion question are going to be the ones who do something with the user experience and not who do the biggest hero run. You know? Like, I don't know if the lack of user experience quality in Microsoft Copilot is dependent on the model needing 2 trillion more tokens and 100 billion more parameters and, you know, a few extra months of training on more B100, B200 instead of H100. It's like, it's user experience studies. It's like software development quality. It's iteration time. It's like not releasing half-baked products. You know, these are lessons that people know with deterministic software that has no AI built in. No, I don't know. We'll see. It's less clear with like a Copilot type experience than it is with a self-driving experience, for example, or with a recommendation engine experience. It's like every release from Tesla Autopilot or from Waymo just makes the car better and safer.
Yeah.
And okay, given enough time, it's just going to get better and safer until the, you know, chance of an accident approaches the asymptote of zero. And the same thing with recommendation engines, right? The click-through rate for people on the next YouTube video or the next TikTok or the next Instagram reel is just like getting better and better. It's more and more high quality, right? Matched to your needs. That stuff is like clearly just the better the model gets, the better the experience gets. I don't get the same feeling with LLMs for personal productivity. There seems to be things missing of like the model just doesn't have access to this data set that I need access to, or it doesn't have this history or something like that.
Yeah. And I think also like that's what inevitably drives people towards hosting their own models because, if this doesn't have the context, I'll give it context, right? Like I'll give it the information that it needs so that when my users interface with it, like it's a positive experience and they actually want to use it more.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking out loud here, but I'm going to jump over to another thing that happened because like it kind of like to go against the point I just made, LLMs do get better over time, right? Like Nemotron is better than 3.170B. 4.0 is better than 4 for ChatGPT. Claude 3.5 is better than Claude 3. Like, and if you have the model in a workflow that is valuable to you, like developing code or something, a better model makes it a better experience, like very clearly, right? The criticism that everybody has, specifically the fun one from last week, was a paper from Apple that was released where, just as a tidbit, Jeffrey Hinton's co-Turing Award winner, Yoshua Bengio's brother, Sammy Bengio, whose name comes up whenever you install, I think, a I don't know, I would always see it when I was running like a PyTorch container or something. He's like one of the credits in there. The abstract is like, is a pretty crazy statement in here. Our findings reveal that LLMs exhibit noticeable variance when responding to different instantiations of the same question. Yeah, like people do too. But they go on to say, we hypothesize that this decline is due to the fact that current LLMs are not capable of genuine logical reasoning. Instead, they attempt to replicate the reasoning steps observed in their training data. And the title of the paper is Understanding the Limitations of Mathematical Reasoning in LLMs. On the surface, this seems reasonable, and it seems like everybody's experience. Hey, sometimes this model hallucinates, it makes something up. But there's a good response, you know, with scare quotes, calling this paper Apple and former DeepMind employees. And he's basically specifically says that they mentioned the concept of can LLMs truly reason in the abstract? And then they never touch the concept of reason again in the paper. It does not contain a reference to a different paper that might tell us what they mean by true logical reasoning or genuine mathematical reason. And like, I don't know, I find this so interesting because these LLMs are completely transformational. Everybody has this experience of this thing writing a blog post or responding to an email or developing some code for you. And they're like, wow, this is crazy. And then they have an experience where it doesn't work for them. It makes up something that doesn't exist. It doesn't know about some, you know, current product that just got released. And they go, oh, this can't actually reason. It's making things up. And they go, like, I just want to read again. LLMs are not capable of genuine logical reasoning. Instead, they attempt to replicate the reasoning steps observed in their training data. What do humans do? How do we learn? We just magically discover how to walk and talk and, right? No, we look around, we listen, we learn from the inputs, and then maybe we learn faster with less examples than LLMs, but like we learn and then we try it and then we fall down and we get back up and then we learn to walk. I don't know what genuine logical reasoning is here. It kind of bothers me a lot.
To me, it's the difference between knowing and understanding, right? Kind of. Like, think about it like that. You know, when you can know all of this information, but like, do you understand it? Like, do you truly understand it and its context of like, you know, and can you understand cause and effect? Can you understand like, so take the, you know, learning to walk example, right? Like everyone likes to say crawl, walk, run. Well, it's because you figure out that you can crawl by moving, you know, your legs and arms, whatever, right? And then you figure out that, oh, if I stand and only move my legs, I can walk, right? Like that's an understanding. That's not that's not a knowledge piece. Like someone didn't like teach that to you. So I almost feel like the researchers were maybe getting at that point, like there's a difference between knowing and understanding, meaning like I know how to solve this problem because I have all the information to solve it versus I understand what all of these functions do. If we're talking about a math problem, for example, like I understand what all of these do. And from there, I can understand how this equation gets solved. It's nuanced a bit, but there is a difference. In my opinion, between knowing and understanding.
Yeah, sure. It makes total sense. I think there's two things here. One is that the weights of the model are not interpretable, where you can like interrogate and say, oh, it has this knowledge inside of it, or it has this understanding inside of it. You need to be proven to show, to demonstrate your knowledge or your understanding in order to prove that you have that in your brain. So people take tests to figure out who's smarter, who knows more about this subject, and tests are always answering a multiple choice test is different than giving a lecture on a topic and answering, you know, arbitrary questions from somebody who's trying to learn. And many people, you know, myself included, would say it's best to like solidify your understanding by teaching, by explaining things to others, because first of all, you get good questions. And second of all, the process of like talking and thinking is good to solidify the understanding, makes it easier. We only really get superficial ways of having the LLM explain its knowledge and its understanding about certain topics. Mm-hmm. And the best example of this is, you know, Ilya Sutskever explaining next token prediction. Playing fill in the blank is not the way we learn about the world as humans, right?
Right.
But if you read a mystery novel about a killer, you know, trying to figure it out, and at the very end of the novel, it has a blank in the middle of the sentence, the killer's name was blank, and you can accurately predict that token from what came in the novel before, that demonstrates a deep understanding of not just the semantics of the English language, which people criticize, oh, this is a superficial understanding, but like a pretty deep understanding of the context of what's inside that novel, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that, certainly in the frame of language, I don't know how that is substituted with something else. And it's always the moving goalposts. Well, LLMs can't do math. Now they can. They can't, you know, plan. Now the agents can. I don't know. Let's see what's coming. But I'm more and more convinced that we lack a proper description for what reasoning is. And
yeah,
we can't, if we have one, we can't create a test that
proves it.
Has the LLM the opportunity to prove it, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, until this is one of those things that, you know, I feel like the community as a whole is going to have to come together and agree on, like, this is the test. You know.
We had one, the Turing test.
Right, exactly.
Came and went.
Came and went. Yep. So now there's like a new test that has to be formulated that says, okay, this is how an LLM can prove that it has truly achieved reasoning capabilities. Sorry, reasoning capabilities.
Yeah. We're going to get, yeah. Grade school reasoning. We're going to get the GSR 8K benchmark soon. set of grade school math. Okay, let's move on. Let me try and do a nice segue here. So we started talking about how Microsoft Copilot spills data. And another experience that uses data and kind of spills it sometimes is Perplexity, which is currently getting sued by the New York Times. We talked about Perplexity before.
We did.
But, you know, and I use it all the time, man. Like, love this application.
Perplexity is great. But what's interesting is, you know, this kind of, New York Times is effectively demanding Perplexity stop using its content for Gen AI purposes. We had talked about this on a prior episode about now we're starting to see these like content wars pop up. You know, the music industry is trying to sue the generative AI music, you know, companies out of business, right? And the New York Times had previously sued OpenAI for the exact same reason, and now it's coming after Perplexity. And New York Times is pissed about it because, of course, the New York Times isn't getting any money from Perplexity for scraping those data, right? So this is a little bit of a continuation of like...
No, Perplexity is an agent. It's got one subscription to the New York Times, and they pay it a dollar an issue or whatever it is.
Yeah.
that yeah. covers it, right?
Yeah, dollar a week. Yeah, no, I know. It's. I feel like it's just a continuation of that issue that we talked about on a previous episode of where, like, you know, all of these companies like the New York Times, like Reddit, like others, you know, because Reddit very famously shut their API off, right, and said, okay, you know, if you want API access, you know, we're going to work out some sort of agreement with you where, like, we'll give you the data via API access to train your model, but you're going to pay us an exorbitant amount of money to do so. And, you know, I think we're heading in that direction with everything. I mean, But, you know, I don't want to rehash the discussion that we had on the previous episode about, like, is this fair use or is it not? Like, you know, if I can get to it as a human being on the open internet without paying for a subscription, what's the big deal? Like, I don't want to rehash that whole thing. It's just interesting that now it's like the New York Times is like war on AI. It feels like.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, and I that seems like the wrong posture to take. I'm not a lawyer, but it seems like being against the magical technology that everybody loves is probably a bad idea. I want to give a real example of like what do I use Perplexity for, right? Because I think it's an AI powered application that is the real true direct competitor to Google search, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Like I type things into Perplexity or I hit the mic button and talk into my phone instead of opening Google and doing, in many cases, multiple searches, checking sometimes multiple links and then finding the answer, scrolling, right?
Yep.
The ability for it to give me a response, which I know sometimes isn't right, and then links to the correct articles directly to go double check which part of it is where, is perfect. And so the example that's much better than Google search, right? I was talking to somebody the other day about big data, right? When were the Hadoop companies founded? I was like, I'm pretty sure they were founded around the 2010s, but the MapReduce paper came out in 2004. In one prompt and like hitting the mic button on the phone, I can go, when was Cloudera, Hortonworks, and MapR founded? And I get one response that includes all three of those things. And I'm done in like literally 15 seconds. This is a different experience than one Google search, when was Cloudera founded? Click on a link, try and scroll down. Second Google search, when was Hortonworks founded, right? And in it, they had, you know, the Perplexity thing had three links to Wikipedia pages where I could go and double check that it was right. It was right for all three of these in this case. So they're doing well with the retrieval. But my point is that this is the new interface people are going to use to get access to a New York Times article. Hey, what's the latest on the, you know, current situation in the U.S. election?
Yeah.
Right. Somebody asked that sort of a question. What's the, you know, current polling at in Pennsylvania? And they search it and there's a link and, you know, they're going to use Perplexity whether or not the New York Times is providing data to it. The question is whether Perplexity is going to provide links to New York Times articles for people to go and read through the whole thing.
Or links to other places.
And, you know, maybe there needs to be an agreement both ways to do this. But it seems, given the experience of Perplexity that I have with my phone right now, it seems unstoppable that that interface won't be the same in the future. And New York Times is open to Google right now. So why not get on board with that interface?
Well, and also too, like Perplexity solves a problem for me that I've long had with Google where like I don't just search things on Google anymore. I haven't in a long time. Like I'm literally crafting search prompts using Google syntax to get better results from my searches or to get to the exact result that I want instead of having to scroll through 10 links to figure out the answer, right? Like I've moved, this was years ago, like moved on to that style of interfacing with Google. To me, one of the things that Perplexity does is it removes that step for me. Like I'm not having to craft a complex prompt to search for something, right? Like you said, I have the experience of like, I pull out my phone and I, you know, speak into it and I ask it a prompt and then boom, here we go, right? Like I'm given the answer.
Yeah, I had a Windows update happen on my laptop here right in the middle of us recording. So we got a...
Of course.
We got a nice one here. User experience couldn't delay the update. Move us on to something else. I'm done with segues for this this episode, I think.
That's all right. But I'll wrap it up real quick just to say, like, I agree with you. I feel like New York Times is kind of taking a wrong side of progress approach to this. And like, you know, if this is going to be the experience that the vast majority of people want when they're searching for information, why are you going to fight that progress? So we will put that to bed. Switching gears, I wanted to talk about AMD and Intel putting the X back in x86.
This is a good one.
This is a really good one. For those of you who have done any sort of software development over the years, or even just have a basic understanding of how x86 instruction sets are implemented, you will find that they are very different despite it being a common architecture. this has been a long-standing problem. In fact, there have even been situations where, you know, over the years, Intel's released a math library that you can build into your application that's supposed to be compatible on any x86 platform. Yet what they did in one of the releases was they added a little check that says, is this processor genuine Intel? And if the answer was no, you lose about half the instruction sets that you should normally have access to, even though the underlying processor supports it. So there's been shit like that over the years going on in this space, and I find it really interesting and refreshing to see that, you know, everyone's coming back together and going, like, we need, like, an ecosystem advisory group to truly make this, you know, everybody works together and plays nice in the sandbox again. And I think that part of this has to be like a little bit of self-serving interest, right? Like Intel and AMD make x86 CPUs. They don't make ARM CPUs. ARM's getting a lot of buzz right now. They're getting increased competition from ARM, especially on the PC side of things, right? With Qualcomm Snapdragon X. And Apple, obviously, with their own custom ARM-based silicon that they're now also building in servers in their data center. You know, Microsoft's got ARM silicon that they're developing. AWS has it. I think they're feeling the threat. And I think the feedback that they've been getting from the x86 community is, we're sick and tired of having to change dependencies and change math libraries when we want to switch between x86 architectures, because they're not the same despite you telling me that they are.
Let me just double down on your point about the ARM competition here, because it's interesting in enterprise server, traditional x86 land, but it's also happened in mobile devices where Qualcomm has a business because Intel wouldn't produce iPhones. And you have it in PCs. I mean, if you know, MacBook having that Apple Silicon M2, M3 chips, right? AWS Graviton, probably the first ARM chip in the, you know, like data center cloud world. But the point is that the ship sailed, right? There was this whole dependency on x86 where everybody developed for x86. And it was kind of esoteric to have like a operating system that supported ARM, and then to have packages on top of that operating system that supported ARM. But like every major OS distribution supports ARM today for Linux, and just about every package that, you know, works on x86 kind of works on ARM, unless they're doing something funky, something special for performance. And it's this trend that I've seen in other industries as well, where as soon as you've lost enough business, you start a customer advisory board with the people who are still buying from you to figure out what you should change, what you should improve. And you know who's not in the room? The people who've already left.
Yeah.
The people who are no longer buying from you. And I just don't know how much they're going to learn, right? The people who buy x86 and will continue to buy x86 are going to give them advice on how to keep them buying x86.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're hearing from Apple and AWS in this advisory board. I didn't look into the details, but.
So the only thing that at least I've been able to find out so far is it said CEOs of major tech companies. I don't know who those people are. You know, are they the OEMs like HPE, Dell, et cetera, or are they the AWSs and Microsofts of the world? I mean, I think the other big thing that's coming and I think this is really going to accelerate things, is, you know, Microsoft is building ARM support into Windows Server 2025.
Mm.
So the next release of Windows Server, by far the most run operating system in the data center space, by far, right, is going to support ARM architecture. That's huge, right?
Yeah.
It's one thing to have Linux distros do it, and they've been able to support it for a while. It's another thing to have Windows Server do it. Like, that's big. And I think that that's going to, we saw this whole shift, like we've seen these shifts in technology over time, where, like, if you remember ESX versus ESXi, like ESX was a bitch to stand up and get up and running, right? ESXi simplified things, which in turn then started the path of everybody virtualizing their servers, right? Because the barrier to entry was lowered. If you put Windows Server on ARM, the barrier to entry is now lowered, right? If you take
every Windows application runs on ARM now, right? Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the barrier to entry, the barrier to switch to ARM has now been lowered. And, you know, we saw this, we've seen this with AI, we've seen this with cloud, we've seen this with Kubernetes, right? I mean, Kubernetes 10 years ago, you know, you needed a PhD to install it, right, and run it. Now it's, okay, yeah, just run this Ansible playbook and you've got it up in an hour. Like, this is evolution, right? The barriers to entry, once they get lowered, that's when the floodgates open.
Well, the mark of this for Kubernetes that I got to see if it's true for ARM is if there's guys in India training people in North America how to do this, then it's been democratized. And mm-hmm. the best way to learn Kubernetes is with Code Cloud, the guys in India. So I got to figure out if there's like a something about the ARM architecture programming for ARM that the guys in India are training people in the US for. Or not, because that's my little litmus test of how how unique this stuff is. But it's cool, man. Like the idea that RISC-V is the new ARM, and mm-hmm. ARM is somewhat of a standard, you know, viable competitor at least to x86 for a lot of different applications is, I think that's encouraging for consumers. And I think the fact that AMD is on board with this x86, you know, advisor group is a great thing, because, like, to be honest, there's been other things in the industry that Intel has tried to go alone, and they kind of peter out.
Yep.
But playing nice with AMD is a good thing. Certainly because they're going to have a hard-fought battle in the GPU business with MI325X being announced, Gaudi 3 coming along. Like, there's a lot of you know, room for competition right now.
So just thinking out loud on this topic, right? Like, I wonder if I feel like at some point sooner or later, every single data center is going to get hit with the ESG wall, where it's like, we're not buying 500 watt TDP CPUs. Like, we're not going to do that anymore, right? And obviously ARM has had, you know, a much lower power draw for similar performance for quite some time. This has been proven over years, right? So with the move to Microsoft enabling ARM support on Windows Server, and more companies kind of leaning into, you know, ESG goals, how does this affect companies' environments, right? I mean, do we start evaluating what workloads can now move to ARM as opposed to continuing to run them on x86 because that's what we've always done for the last 30 years, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll be interested to see that, because, you know, if I can drop my power footprint by a fifth, I don't need small modular reactors to run it, right? Like, I'm good on the power grid you gave me. Like, I don't need SMRs.
Yeah, yeah. So, and by the way, I have the press release from AMD up here. So the founding members, it includes Microsoft, and a quote from Satya. It includes Oracle, and it includes Google Cloud, quote from CEO Thomas Kurian. Broadcom, Dell, HPE, HP Inc., Lenovo, Red Hat, rounded out. No AWS.
Okay. So you basically have all of the you basically have all of the members of the DMTF consortium represented here. So that's good to hear, but no Apple, of course. Not that surprised. I mean, you know, I read through
and no
their
AWS.
Entire
no AWS.
Yeah, but I mean, going back to what we mentioned towards the beginning of this podcast, like AWS is going to AWS, right? I mean, they're just going to do their own thing at this point. That seems to be their MO. They're like, yeah, that's great. That's cool that you guys are doing that. We don't care.
Yeah. No NVIDIA. No NVIDIA giving them advice on x86. No ARM.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit of a split. It's a bit of a split, I think. I'm not encouraged by industry consortiums that exclude very important, you know, prospects or customers here. Like, I think it'll make x86 better for the companies just listed, but the whole reason why they need this board is because there's a bunch of people not using x86 thanks to, I would say, primarily AWS, Apple, and Qualcomm.
Mm-hmm. So just to touch on something, right? Like, what I would want to understand before I make a judgment call is, was NVIDIA and Apple and these folks, were they invited and they said no? Or were they just left out because the x86 players are like, well, if you're going to design your own ARM chips, then fuck you. Like, you're not invited to the party. And the reason I point that out is because, you know, when the Gen Z Consortium was first founded, which, horrible name, by the way, for those of you who don't know what it is not the generation of human beings. It was the consortium that was founded to further the development of silicon photonics, right? And so, curiously, who was not in that foundation was Intel. Everyone else, I mean, AMD, Cisco, Arista, Juniper, Dell, HPE, Lenovo, Supermicro, like, it was the who's who of the data center industry, except for Intel. Why? Well, Intel was developing CXL. CXL is a competitor, or was at that time,
yep,
to Gen Z. So they're like, well, I'm doing my own thing. Why am I going to join this and give you guys all this intellectual property? Like, forget that. And then what was even more interesting that happened is the Gen Z consortium ended up getting merged into the CXL consortium. So Intel won that battle, right? By going out on their own. For whatever reason, they won that battle. I'm not clear on the details, but all that to say, I'm wondering, is this a situation where they were invited and said no, like what happened with the Gen Z consortium? Or is this a situation where they just weren't invited at all because of their very public moves away from x86 for certain things?
Yeah, well, I'll just give an alternative here of, because they're top of mind, the OCP summit just happened, and that's a consortium that I think is obviously working, with founding, you know, board members from Microsoft, Meta, Google, Intel, advisory board members including AMD, ARM, Seagate, NVIDIA, Ampere, Samsung, and Supermicro, and a steering committee that includes all of those people.
Yeah.
Plus Samsung, plus Nokia. I'm looking at it right now. That's a pretty comprehensive, you know, list there when you consider that, like, OCP takes input from obviously AMD, NVIDIA, and Intel when you're constructing the board, right? Another one, for example, is Ultra Ethernet. So basically everybody, even including Cisco, Arista, and Broadcom, right? That's, you know, It's a Juniper, right? Like, you can't buy a switch from somebody who produces an Ethernet switch. That doesn't include a member of the Ultra Ethernet Consortium. And so maybe a distinction between these is that OCP and Ultra Ethernet were basically founded by Meta, by Facebook, right? So basically a buyer of the technology rather than a producer of the technology. Mm-hmm. And I'm not totally convinced this x86 consortium is going to produce anything meaningful for customers. Let's see.
Yeah, it's hit or miss with these consortiums, right? Because there's some that have worked and some that haven't. One very notable one that's worked is the Redfish Consortium. It has gotten so easy for data center automation now, where I'm not interfacing with 20 different APIs to provision an application. I'm interfacing with one, right? As long as everything in my environment is Redfish compliant, it can be multi-vendor. I can automate it, right? And I don't have to think too hard about API integration to all these disparate systems, which was definitely not the case even 10 years ago. That's an example of an industry consortium in my mind that worked. SPDM, that's another example of a consortium that worked, right? Where we're taking this concept of using X509 certificates to authenticate devices with devices so that we can cut down on malicious attacks and hardware. That was something everyone got behind, and that's now something that every single hardware manufacturer has enabled for hardware security. So those are two examples of things that in my mind have worked really well. Things that are yet to see whether they work well or not, I would put the CXL consortium on that list because, you know, I feel like I've been hearing about Silicon Photonics for, 9 years. And, you know, I can't find a single device that's shipping out on the market. Like, if I Google CXL devices, I see Samsung's got one, Micron's got one, but I can't order it as far as I can tell, right? So, like, and if I look at the data center space, like, we were promised, oh, you're going to have these CXL device bays and it looks like a deck of cards and you just slide it in and now you've got a terabyte of DRAM or you got a whatever, a GPU, an FPGA, a neuromorphic processor. There's a throwback term for you.
That's coming back again too, man. Neuromorphic is whatever. Yeah.
I haven't seen it. Right. I think it, to your point, it's a kind of a crapshoot or remains to be seen whether this is actually going to work or not.
Yeah. I want to point out one thing about these. You name like Redfish from DMTF, which is a 501c charity or standards organization, mm-hmm. which is like the Apache Foundation, yep. which is like the CNCF project, part of the Linux Foundation, right?
I think it's 503c.
503?
Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
It's a charity or a nonprofit.
It's a charity or, yeah, whatever.
Right? This is not like a company with tens of billions of dollars of market cap or hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap inviting people to tell them how to build their products. I think it's a very different thing. And masquerading as a foundation or as a something like that, it's certainly not doing that. So I'm not trying to compare the two in that way, but I'm saying like the result being a standard. X86 is a standard, the way Redfish is a standard, the way Ethernet is a standard, right? Engineers get in a room and decide, they make technical decisions. We're going to do this, not that. Mm-hmm. That seems to operate the best when it's not effectively controlled by a for-profit company or two for-profit companies, right? It seems to operate best when it's controlled by a company that buys the technology or a groundswell sort of, you know, charity kind of open style consortium. So, you want to talk about AI interconnect bandwidth and CXL and then wrap up, or?
Yeah, that sounds like a plan. So, a listener actually brought this to our attention, but it appears that there's a new photonics interconnect that's being worked on to basically increase the bandwidth of interconnects by 10x. Okay, great. As I just mentioned, I've been hearing about photonics for many years and have yet to see something materialize. So while I think it's cool, I'm not sure that we're going to see this materialize, at least not anytime soon. Well, I would agree with you that there's this push to go to 800 gig interconnects and 1.2 terabit interconnects. And there's even a roadmap out to like 2.4, I think, at this point, which is mind blowing to me, right? That we can push that much down a wire. And I mean, we could go down to through a whole rat hole of like how much that really sucks from a latency perspective. But we can save that for another time. Given that push, right, towards these higher interconnects, like, I'm trying to figure out, like, is the reason for this existing because we're getting to like the limitations of copper? Like, is optical the only way that we increase bandwidth? Because even now on 400 gig switches, right, if you're doing short runs, you can use copper cabling, right? You don't have to use optical cabling. But are we getting to the point where that's no longer feasible? Like, I literally cannot push enough electrons down this material, similar to, you know, what's been talked about for several years about, like, oh, you know, we've stretched the limits of silicon. We can no longer do anything. That's why we had to start stacking it, because we literally cannot get it any thinner, any more transistors, et cetera. Like, have we reached that limit? And that's why there's renewed interest in silicon photonics?
Well, if you scroll down in this article, or I'll throw my screen up.
Yeah.
It's got this chart: diverse LLM workloads drive disaggregated fabric architectures. And this can get pretty technical pretty quick. But the point is that there's different workload profiles that require different mixes of compute with memory bandwidth. It's the oldest benchmarking description, or the oldest benchmarking problem for computer hardware that exists, right? The fundamentals of a computer, there's basically two types of operations. There's operations that add and multiply, and there's operations that load and store data. And if your application has more add multiply, or if it has more load store during the runtime, then you want to, you know, take care of that piece of it, remove the long pole in the tent, right? In other words,
Yeah. Okay,
I need to spend a lot of time loading and storing data. I need more memory bandwidth to speed up my application, because any more compute won't be useful. It's just going to sit around waiting for data, and vice versa is the same. If I don't have enough compute, I can't actually, you know, do anything with the data, no matter how much I push in. And there's lots of descriptions. The best like visual for this is a factory, right? Are you getting more raw materials in, or are you having more assembly lines working on the raw materials? Don't have to go through all that in detail, but the point about LLMs is that the workloads are diverse, in that the mix of the amount of memory bandwidth you need with the amount of compute that you have on the GPU is dependent on like every single LLM that gets released. And you kind of need to match the amount of memory bandwidth and the amount of compute to that. Conceptually, having a interconnect fabric with silicon photonics that has low power, you know, it doesn't get hot, it doesn't consume a lot of energy, would allow us to switch between, okay, right now the H100 GPU has 80 gigs of memory, but now I've got the H100 with the same amount of compute with 40 gigs of memory, and then the leftover 40 is going to my next GPU, which has 80 gigs of memory, and then it becomes 120 gig GPU with the same amount of compute. And I can put one model that's compute constrained on the first one, and one model that's memory bandwidth constrained on the second one. Conceptually, this makes sense, and I think engineers are excited about like the modularity of a system of this nature, where you could match it to a given workload.
Mm-hmm.
From a business perspective, it makes no sense to me. People deploy these LLMs at data center scale.
Yeah.
Like Facebook or Meta is running LLMs for their chatbots. They're running LLMs for summarizing documents. They're running a recommendation model. They're running vision models, all sorts of stuff. Just buy specific servers for the specific workload that you're doing. It's just not going to be like half of a quarter of a server for one LLM and half a quarter of the server for the next one. It's like, it doesn't make any sense. These guys scale at the size of data centers, not even a rack, let alone, you know, a kind of like switch the chip on demand inside the system. So,
well,
who knows?
And it's,
there's people smarter than me working on this problem, so maybe they know something I don't, but I don't know.
I did think it was interesting, the chart that they showed about how you can program the laser at different wavelengths to address different workloads, like AI training, you know, 5G, 6G, and then inference. But, I mean, that would require someone to have this technology deployed everywhere, which I don't think is a realistic expectation of any vendor. Like, it seems like such a lofty thing to me, too.
Well, okay, yeah. I was kind of – I think we're talking about two separate things. So
we
certainly
are.
Cranking up the throughput of a network interconnect between GPUs is, like, a thing to do, especially when it's a cluster that's running multiple workloads.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, having tunables on the network down to the laser level would be a cool thing. I'm sure it would make things go faster. The near-term utility of this, I think basically we're going to hit AGI or not hit AGI on a model run that happens in a pre-silicon photonics enabled system. like people are kind of going to decide whether they're going to do the $1 trillion training run on like a, you know,
sorry,
traditional network.
It's the
on an Ethernet network.
According to Sequoia, it's the $1.2 trillion training run, actually.
Yeah. And then that thing's going to either like take us to the promised land or kill everybody, and silicon photonics will not be included in the production scale deployment of a cluster that does a $1 trillion training run.
Yeah.
like first of all, the $100 billion training run needs to work, which, you know, I got my doubts.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, as we may have mentioned before, there's probably two ways it's going to go, right? Like, we're either going to hit it, and then this is the end result. Or
Hector's got a picture of Skynet on the screen.
or we're not going to hit it, and then people are going to go back to the drawing board and be like, okay, how do we, you know, what do we have to move towards to hit it? But I think what's interesting about AGI specifically is what you were talking about earlier about the goalposts constantly being moved. Like, are we going to see that same scenario play out with AGI where, like, well, it's not really that because it can't, you know, understand this context or something, so it doesn't have true reasoning capabilities, so throw it out, right? It doesn't pass this XYZ arbitrary test, like, so it's not fucking AGI. Like, you know, are we going to see that same kind of thing where, like, people just get into a pissing contest about what is and isn't AGI? Similar to how, like, we're seeing this now in not just the enterprise space, but the consumer space of like, what is and isn't AI, right? Like, because you build a fucking ChatGPT endpoint into your shitty mobile app, like, is that AI? Like, is that what we're doing now? Like, we're just going to slap that together and call it AI? Like, I mean, that's like, I feel like it's going to get to a little bit of that. You know, where people are going to claim, like, you know, I could see, you know, Sam Altman claiming like, oh, well, yep, we've got AGI, we've hit it. And then everybody else is like using it. And you have all these scientists pick it apart and go, well, this isn't actually AGI. Like, this is a piece of shit. Like, is, you know, you're just doing, you know, black box magic behind the scenes to call it AGI. Like, I don't know. Like, is there a scenario like that that plays out?
I don't know, man. I think we kind of need to just take off for the weekend. And you've had 5 days back from vacation. I think you're good, man. Whatever. We can litigate AGI next week, I guess.
I know. I went off on a tangent there for a minute, but I felt
no.
It needed to be said.
Yeah, it's good. It's all good. Hey, this is fun.
Yeah. Until next week.